which is McClinton versus Capstone, 24-11261.
Yeah.
Thank you both. All right, we have Mr. Harold here for the appellant. We have a Ms. Edwards and a Mr. Edwards here for the appellee. Any relation?
Yeah.
Terrific. This is the first for me. Okay, so Mr. Harold, you've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Edward F. Harold on behalf of Collins Capstone Logistics, David Class, and Brian Holbrook. An appeal after a jury trial contains a lot more information than summary judgment or a more legal situation. So I will try to focus. I want to focus on a few issues today. I want to focus on the definition of disability. I want to focus on errors in the remedies that were awarded in this case. And finally, I'm going to spend a few minutes on the sanctions. But I am compelled today to begin with the remedies. And that is because the most practical, significant issue in this case for my client is being required to reinstate Mr. McClinton to a job that does not exist. So after trial, when plaintiff moved for equitable relief, the judge ordered us to reinstate Mr. McClinton. Now, there's uncontroverted evidence in the record that my client Capstone was contracted to Dollar General at a facility in February of 2022.
So here's the thing. I think in theory, your argument makes sense, but I've got the affidavit that was filed. And it seems like there's just one affidavit in the record that says that this thing was closed. And all it says is it explains that it was closed. And it says there are currently no supervisor positions available within a 45-mile radius of Birmingham, Alabama. That doesn't seem to mean that there's no way to hire this guy to a position within 45. It just means there's no open positions available.
Okay. First, there is other evidence in the record of what happened with the contract and the facility closing.
No question happened, the facility closed. Do you still have, I guess the point is, this is a judicial mandate that you hire somebody. So the fact that you don't have supervisor positions available was not the remedy question, right? It's not like we're currently advertising for a supervisor position. That's not the question, right?
Well, the question on this is it's a matter of equity and equitable relief. Mm-hmm. Back pay, reinstatement, and the front pay are all matters of equity. And the core principle of equity is that the plaintiff be put back in the position he would have been in had the unlawful conduct not occur. That's what equity does. And it's for that reason that after we close the facility, and it's not just the affidavit was to explain to the court, we don't have a similar position, we don't have something else. At the time she was making that decision, after trial.
When the facility was closed, what happened to the other great supervisor who was similarly situated?
He was terminated.
He was terminated?
Yes.
And were the other employees, like this other supervisor, given anything like severance pay or anything of that nature that
McClintock
didn't get?
I do not know the answer to that question. There was no evidence put on at trial other than we terminated these employees. We had no other contracts in the area. We tried to move people. We were unable to move these people. Everybody who was working at the Dollar General facility lost their job in February 2022.
Can I just go get back to Judge Brasher's question?
Yes.
So I take your point that this is sort of a feature of equity jurisdiction to make whole. But what if equity can't quite get all the way there? Okay, so the exact position that this dude was in is not available anymore. But in answer to Judge Brasher, are you saying there are simply no spots that might vaguely approximate the position that this guy was in?
Correct.
That's not what the affidavit said.
Well,
though.
and perhaps the affidavit was inartful. What we tried to do was get the information about what Capstone positions, what work we had within a 45-mile radius of Birmingham, which was the, and we went to Mr. Fernandez and we talked to the talent, and that is the affidavit we put together.
This may be like the dumbest analogy of all time or hypothetical of all time, but I mean, like, if you had somebody on a maintenance crew, if you had a spot on a maintenance crew, that's not perfect equity, but it's imperfect equity, and it might begin to scratch and claw its way toward something that equity might recognize.
If you go back to where this, all these concepts come out of the National Labor Relations Act, and some of the orders back from the 70s do look at a substantially equivalent position if the person's position is no longer available. So yes, there is some sort of there is the potential for an order to try to do some rough relationship between. However, the order here specifically said a supervisor position. We don't have a supervisor position currently within 45 miles of Birmingham that's not currently filled by an active
but
employee.
That's the point, though. That's the point. It doesn't matter whether you have an open position. You're not, this isn't like just regular hiring. You're being ordered to hire this person because you violated his rights. This isn't like, well, you got to consider him for an open position because, like, you should. I mean, that's not what this remedy is. This remedy is you have to hire him whether you have an open position or not.
And with the courts, that's what the remedy.
David just says we are hiring right now for supervisor positions, which is not relevant at all, right?
Well, what's relevant is what the courts have said about this situation is if there is no open position, that reinstatement is infeasible.
They said open position.
Right.
You have to have a vacant position.
You do not have to bump any current employee.
Okay. Who said that? And what's your site for that?
It is in my brief.
Okay.
I have cited it in the section in my brief. I'm fairly certain it's there.
So just help me with this, because I guess I don't remember this. I'll trust you that it's in the brief, but I don't remember this in the brief either. I guess I remember there being some vague disconnect. I certainly read the case that says reinstatement isn't necessary when it's not feasible. And then there were some follow-on cases that say, like, you know, it's not always feasible when there would be, discord and antagonism. Right?
That's one.
But what you're saying is there are also cases that say it's not feasible when there is no open position.
And what I'm remembering from the brief is the EEOC guidance that said reinstatement may not be feasible, and then gave four separate examples of situations in which reinstatement may not be feasible. And if I'm remembering that correctly from my brief, one of them was the position is no longer available.
Right, the position is no longer available, right, in the sense that you can't, not that it's not open, but that you just couldn't hire the person, right? So obviously, if you had closed all facilities, had no more operations, you went bankrupt, for example, you wouldn't have to hire the guy. But I don't see anywhere. Well, I'll look in the brief. You don't know the case. I'll look in the brief and see if there's anything in there. Let me ask you. It seems like your broader argument is not really about this. Your broader argument, which I think has maybe some merit to it, is that, look, we would have fired this guy or laid him off or terminated him anyway at February of whatever, 2022, because we closed this facility down.
Right.
And so that's what makes it inequitable. It's not that, like, we're not currently seeking a supervisor. It's that, like, look, had he stayed with us, had we not terminated him because of his disability, we would have terminated him anyway. Make that argument.
Well, that's correct. And again, it goes back to the equity principle, which is you're entitled to be reinstated or made whole for the damages that were caused by the unlawful conduct. But that make whole takes into account post unlawful conduct events that may change that measure of damages. Here, and there's case law, if you would have lost the position otherwise is one of those things that's taken into account. And that is why we put on the evidence at trial of the facility closing, was because it is evidence of where the back pay should be cut off, that reinstatement is
unwarranted. So on the back pay, though, issue,
you agreed to a jury instruction that said he got back. You submitted a jury instruction that said he got back pay through trial.
Yes, and that comes out of the 11th Circuit pattern instructions. So perhaps that's not my strongest argument, but yeah. It is the same.
So on principle, that seems like a serious problem.
But on the principle, the equitable principle that should have terminated back pay, and that I would say the judge should have been allowed under, because it is an equitable remedy, the judge should have been allowed to fix that. But that's the same reason that reinstatement is not warranted, and that even if we, you know, there's no reason to remand for front pay, because it would cut off, if reinstatement was infeasible, your next step would be to look at, you know, this front pay then an appropriate remedy. And front pay is not an appropriate remedy under equity, because he would have lost the job in February of 2022.
Can you address what I think is one of your stronger arguments, perhaps, about the calculation of the damages to the FMLA interference claims?
Certainly.
I don't think I quite understand what happened there, to be honest with you.
I'm not sure I do either. The claims, there were two claims at trial. There was FMLA interference and FMLA retaliation. And there was great confusion throughout the case over what exactly the conduct was that constituted interference versus what the conduct was that constituted retaliation. And there were significant arguments about the jury instructions and what conduct could be retaliation and what conduct could be interference. And what ended up happening was the judge said the interference claim is based on Capstone's failure to provide the FMLA paperwork to Mr. McClinton when he went out on FMLA leave to have his back surgery. So we did not, that's what the judge decided the interference was, the conduct that constituted interference. And we did not give him that paperwork at the time. We gave him the number to HR. There was fact dispute over whether he called HR or not, but it's not disputed that he didn't get the paperwork, at least when he went out for his back surgery. Now, while he was out for his back surgery, because it didn't get reported to HR, he also continued getting his salary, and he got disability benefits on top of that. So what we say there is, yes, we screwed up. We didn't give him the paperwork, but he didn't suffer any economic damages. The FMLA is unquestionably limited, not just interference claims, retaliation claims as well. And the Supreme Court has said this clearly, economic damages only, actual damages, no pain and suffering, no compensatory damages. Instead, it has a liquidated damages provision, which takes care of those other things. So if somebody has actual damages, then the judge can double those and they'll be liquidated. Well, in this case, they did not prove any economic damages. The jury awarded the identical amount for the FMLA interference claim, which dealt with his back injury, not his termination, that it awarded for the compensatory damages for the ADA claim. The judge, in upholding that award, pointed to this kind of drawn out of hypothetical testimony that maybe Mr. McClinton's back was injured because he came back too early, and that supports the FMLA interference damage award. That is not an allowable damage under the FMLA. That he did not prove the damages for the FMLA interference claim, and it should have been overturned on that reason. But I'm
okay.
Very well. Tom, I'm sorry.
Yep, no, it's all good. I kept you up there. You got 3 minutes of rebuttal time remaining. All right, Ms. Edwards, you're starting off with 7, correct? Just so I know, how are you guys splitting this?
I'm going to do FMLA, and he's going to do AD.
Okay. So yeah, go ahead.
Okay. A couple of years ago, this court held that an argument is abandoned if a party makes only a passing reference, a reference to its background, or it just buries it within the scope of other argument. That was Barry v. Crestwood in 2023. As far as the FMLA, the last topic that our opponent was speaking of, in their new judgment as a matter of law, they made no argument in their initial brief about the back pay award for Ruminature or anything. They just said that they should get no back pay. They didn't mention that it should be, make the argument they are now making before this court until it was in a footnote in their reply brief.
Below you mean? In the district court.
Yes, sir.
But it's kind of like fully fleshed out here, right?
It is.
And didn't the district court address this argument?
Yes.
But the district court didn't say it was waived. I'm not going to address it, right?
She did say it was waived, okay. Because of this court held in Ray Ngidi and Barry Crestwood and in
where is the district court's opinion? And I'm sure I trust you that it's in there, but there's a lot of that opinion. The district court judge says that they've waived this argument because I see where they say it's a footnote in the reply brief.
Mm-hmm. He said it was because it was not in her initial order that footnotes won't be heard in subsequent briefs, and because that this court has heard many times that if you don't first raise it on your first motion, it's waived.
Yeah, I guess I'm just trying to find out where the district court says I'm denying this because it was waived. I see where the district court's order notes that it was raised for the first time in the reply brief and says, like, yada, 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 you shouldn't have done that.
I'm looking.
This is page 21.
Page 19 to 20-ish. But that's just from my notes, not from the order. So just so I'm clear, did she say that any argument about this being sort of a non-recoverable item of damages was waived, or that the FMLA interference provisions provide for two categories of damages? One is kind of like lost wages, and the other one is like other monetary losses.
The court didn't address it at all.
Did she say that the whole thing was waived, or that the second of those, that sort of prong two, category two damages was waived?
The argument that the damages should be lowered, or even that the issue should be addressed because they didn't first waive it. They addressed it first in the reply brief in a footnote. But she just said, based on 11th Circuit precedent, that it's not going to be heard.
So maybe we'll get to the bottom of all this forfeiture waiver.
Okay, I did see a sentence on page 20 that says the court declines to consider this argument. So you're right.
It's off of the last paragraph on 19 of her memorandum.
If we were to pierce through to the merits of that argument, what's your best argument that this is a recoverable item of damages? It seems to me like this can't be, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems like it can't be a category two damages thing, because that's capped at 12 weeks of salary, right? And $200,000 is like wildly disproportionate to 12 weeks of salary. And so it must be a category one. Uh-huh. A category one seems to me to say like lost wages or salary.
Yes. So the jury instructions that they repeatedly asked for, as you mentioned earlier, said that it's either net wages and net loss of wages and benefits, or it's the 12 weeks that you talked about. And so because it said that, it says up until the jury date, the verdict date. They didn't object to that language. They never said, oh, no, it should just be 12 weeks. It should go into this prong. We probably had about four jury instruction conferences, and every single time they were very adamant on anything with the FMLA, especially interference, that it would, but the language says in the jury instructions, and that is on page 53, document 158.1, page 53, that it would go up until the verdict date. So we construe that if you were to listen to this argument, our best argument would be that they could have picked any day where he had interference. Interference when they didn't give him any FMLA paperwork during his first surgery when he was out for a month. Interference when he came back to work after a month and he was needing more time to recover. Interference when he was working 48 hours a week and they gave him 74 hours to work during the weekends as well. Interference when he had to use for a cane or crutches. Interference when Tiffany Team, where the HR representative, said don't do anything to his status, he's FMLA eligible. There are so many things that the jury heard where they could have decided the date of interference for net lost wages and benefits up until the verdict. The other thing I would like to address was the first part.
So before you get there, the $200,000, none of that was for non-economic damages?
It's hard for me to determine what the jury sought after. It could have been non-economic. My client testified that he's had surgeries, and they could have just given a number for that. I don't know. I'm not sure.
But I mean, I think I'm telling you, yes, reading the statute, that's unlawful.
Right.
So you should be probably saying that we didn't get unlawful damages. So that should probably be your
right. I think it was probably that first argument.
All right, here, let's just go back to this waiver issue. So my notes, I don't know. I'm not sure. This was not the most cleanly litigated case, I think we could fairly say. So my notes say that they raised this argument about not having any damages multiple times during the course of trial. They moved for directed verdict on this. Why would they have to say exactly the same thing in a post-trial motion? But didn't they move for a directed verdict on the FMLA claim on the idea that he didn't have any economic damages?
I believe they moved for everything.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and then the district court denied that motion for directed verdict on the FMLA claim.
I thought the only thing that the district court said was waived is the new argument made for the first time in the post-judgment motion that the reply brief on the post-judgment motion that to the extent the jury was proceeding under the second damages category, that had to be capped to 12 weeks. But I didn't think that they had forfeited or waived the sort of a grander argument that, like, this is an unlawful award. Am I wrong about that?
I believe so. I'm not saying you're right.
I would never say you're wrong.
but the way I read it is that it would not be heard because it wasn't first mentioned. And the other thing I want to bring up is about the damages being stopped because the location closed down. Capstone waived that argument as well. They never made an argument in court about that.
Ask you a question. Is that an FMLA issue or an ADA issue?
It's a back pay issue, but I just wanted to touch on that.
Okay.
Yes. And so they waived that argument. And I just wanted to talk about that. The judge said that they argued that it was infeasible.
You're over your time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think he can cover this.
Sure. Sure.
Okay. Good.
Good morning. I'd just like to clarify one thing about the question of the FMLA interference damages in regards to whether the jury awarded non-economic, i.e., compensatory pain and suffering damages for the $200,000. The answer is no. The verdict or the jury instructions that they had back in the jury room never mentioned anything about awarding damages for pain and suffering, mental anguish.
I completely agree with that. But if then what is the basis for the economic damages for the FMLA? Isn't it just the same thing as the ADA? Aren't they just giving double damages for the same economic damages?
I think ironically, the damages that were awarded in the ADA case, the number 200,000, the ADA claim, if you look at the computations that we briefed, if you take what he was making and then multiply that by the what the instructions ask for, the date of an alleged violation under the interference bucket, to get to the date of the verdict, the jury could have come to a conclusion that the math is some of them could have been 211,000 or 205,000. The amount of wages he lost was around that 200,000 number. And so if you do the math that way, you could see, okay, the jury, which I know we can't get in the mind of the jury could have just rounded down to that 200,000 number, which ironically happens to be the same amount that they awarded him in the other claims.
I guess that's why I'm confused. What is the FMLA? If we look at it, the FMLA is just economic damages. What is that paying him for that the ADA damages isn't paying him for?
Well, it would be per the instruction that they had, it would be lost wages from any violation that occurred before he was terminated. So what essentially happened was...
Right. So the ADA is termination through trial.
Correct.
And you would say the FMLA is sort of like denial of, I don't know, like his request to go and leave or whatever that was right around there.
Yes, because a curative instruction was given which said any other alleged violation, you must decide under the interference claim. And the retaliation instruction said, if you're just considering termination, you must decide under the retaliation claim. Well, the jury decided no for retaliation. So what that means is any other alleged violation could have been he went out on back surgery for a month. You know, he could have needed time for that.
And do you dispute factually that he was paid?
Do I dispute the fact that he was paid during that time?
Without?
No.
Then I think I don't understand anymore. I'm like, what are the lost wages? I mean, I think we now agree that these have to be, for FMLA interference, they got to be lost wages. What wages did he lose if he was being paid? Maybe I'm missing something.
Yes, Your Honor. That wasn't an isolated incident. He also was in the ER a few days and said he needed some time off. He could have lost wages that way. And
not get the $200,000?
From the date of the loss to the date of the verdict is the way the jury instructions read, Your Honor.
I do want to talk to you about the equitable issue, so I don't want to belabor this point, but I guess the question that we're trying to figure out is if from the date of termination to the date of the verdict, he gets the ADA damages, where does the FMLA come in and say, we're giving you something for something else that happened to you besides your lost wages from the date of termination to the date of the verdict? Where's the lost wages before the date of termination?
Are you asking what specific scenario?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to figure out where did he lose wages that isn't already paid for by the ADA claim?
Your Honor, there was one situation where he was paid when he was off of back surgery.
But I guess enough lost wages, setting aside the ADA portion of the award, enough lost wages to get him $200,000 separate and apart from post-termination?
Yes, Your Honor, because the jury essentially had option A or option B. Option B, if they found that he did not directly lose, and I know I'm reading to you what you already
read. Rather than do that, because I agree with Judge Brasher, let's talk about the reinstatement bit.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So on the reinstatement, I think where's the equity in saying, look, we shut this warehouse down, we fired everybody that works there. In February of 2022, but the court is going to make us hire this guy back. Where if he had worked for us in February of 2022, we would have terminated him then, like we did everybody else. Like, where's the equity in that?
Where's the equity in forcing him to come work for
us? Isn't he getting a benefit by the fact that they violated his civil rights and terminated him because of his disability? If you require a reinstatement under these circumstances, aren't you giving him like an extra benefit because of that? Because otherwise he would have been terminated in February 22, but now he gets a job going forward.
Your Honor, I can't say that he would get a quote extra benefit because the remedy of reinstatement is something he is entitled to under the law. So I would have to say
that sort of begs the question. Yeah, we're asking you whether he is entitled to it under the law.
We agree that he is.
Let's start with this premise. He is entitled to be put in the position that he would have been in had this bad stuff never happened to him, right? That's what he's entitled to. He gets back pay, all that kind of stuff, to make it so that had they not fired him because of his disability, he gets made whole, right? Okay. How is reinstatement making him whole if he would have been terminated in February 2022 like everybody else?
Your Honor, there was some testimony at trial that from Mr. Fernandez that there was a traveling team that traveled around through the company. But it's kind of unknown whether he would have been a part, able to join that team. I don't know. Mr. Fernandez didn't seem to know the answer to that either.
So it sounds like your position is, we don't really know that he would have been terminated in February 2022. That's just something that defendant says, and we don't really know whether that's true or not.
Your Honor, that's their contention. I don't know, you know, hypothetically.
What your contention have, that he could have joined this traveling team and maybe continued to have a job going forward?
Yes, if we would have had more information about that, yes, we contend that he could have joined that travel team.
Was the other similarly situated supervisor assigned to the traveling team?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Do we know from the record what happened to all of the other employees who were not assigned to the traveling team? Were they reassigned to a different facility? Do we know that from the record?
I could say, I would be assuming that some of them got other jobs within a certain radius, but I would be just making an assumption by saying that.
Okay, very well. Thank you so much for your argument. Mr. Harold, you got 3 minutes remaining.
Yes, Your Honor, just on the issue of the waiver, that was about our argument that it should have been limited to 12 weeks, that even if the award from the jury was somehow appropriate under the FMLA, what the district judge said was, you didn't point out that 12-week limitation in the statute properly, so I'm not going to lower this $200,000 to the statutory maximum of 12 weeks of salary. But as to what that award is for, the judge certainly didn't think it was for back pay. Because in her decision, she wrote it was because his back might have been hurt when he come back, which is unlawful under the FMLA, as you pointed out. If there's nothing particular, I would like to just spend a minute on the sanctions issue because it, as a litigator, this is something that is significant to me. Judge Manasco did not find that we, in the brief, made a statement of fact that was unsupported by record evidence. She was upset that we contended the evidence made it undisputed that Mr. McClinton made that change to the paperwork. And if you read her order, it's the contention that it was undisputed. Now, I've been doing this for a long time, and I've rarely sat across from a plaintiff in an employment discrimination case that admitted the misconduct that we said we fired him. I didn't do it is the constant refrain.
You never contested that you made a misrepresentation, though, did you?
I'm not sure. I believe in our responses in the below, and what we said on appeal is that we didn't make a misrepresentation about, we submitted a statement of fact that Mr. McClinton made the change.
You falsely represented that a disputed fact was undisputed.
Well, that's what I'm...
Yeah. So I think your point is that when you filed your motion for summary judgment, you filed it before they filed something to dispute the fact, right? And so when you filed your motion for summary judgment, you said, this is an undisputed fact.
And then they filed and said, here's the evidence that makes it disputed.
Right.
And it's that process that I feel kind of blindsided by. It's not our job to go out and parse their evidence and make their case for them in our opening brief. And I have won many summary judgments because my evidence has been so overwhelming that the plaintiff saying, and it's not even just in a good faith belief case. In other cases, I've had evidence that's so overwhelming that the judge won't accept the plaintiff's, I didn't do it, as enough evidence to let the case go to trial. That's different in every case.
On this issue, I tend to appreciate where you're coming from on that. But on this issue, it seems like one of the things you could have done to have nip this in the bud, and I just want to address whether this was something you did, is in your statement of undisputed facts, you could have disclosed that the plaintiff testified to the opposite of this.
We could have, yes.
And I think that's kind of what the district court is pointing out, is you took the plaintiff's deposition, he said the opposite of what you're saying, And yet you were just walking along with your motion like nobody had ever said anything different. And it was sort of a failure to disclose that to the court that I think was maybe the judge's concern.
We did not put it in the statement of undisputed material facts, but very clearly, and we didn't detail out what his testimony was, but in the memorandum in support of summary judgment, we certainly referred to plaintiff's, plaintiff's contrary testimony or something like that. There is a reference in, I think, paragraph 9 of the motion itself, and then on page 29 of the memo, both which make a reference to plaintiff's contrary testimony. Now, we did not go through it. We didn't cite what it was. We didn't quote his deposition testimony. There were 1,000 issues in this case. There wasn't a lot of room under the strictures. I didn't even have room in the brief here to talk about everything. But I'm out of time, and I appreciate it.
Yep, very well. Thank you. That case is submitted. We'll move to the third case of the day, which is McNair versus Johnson, 24-10153.